Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 11, delivered on September 24, 2014. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. And to begin, I am going to go through a couple of metrics of risk with you. Now, there are different ways to describe risk. In business, we like to use numbers, as in any kind of quantitative approach, but that's not the only way you can measure risk. Risk could be measured by a word like meh, or uh-oh, or oh my God, or we could go to a number. Just say, on a scale of 1 to 10, what's the risk of this project? But there are other ways that we can measure risk, too. One of the basic meanings, of risk, we could use the term volatility. Like, for example, I could say, well, let's just look at the volatility of a stock price and say, what does that tell us about this company's stock in terms of risk? So without further ado, let me show you a couple of stocks and see what we have here, okay? So So let's try this. Apple stock. And see what we can do. Okay. So I'm going to show you Apple, first of all. There's Apple's stock price. Now, volatility, more or less, just means how much does it go? Oh, will you get off? God, I hate those pop-ups. Those just make my ass itch. Son of a... Volatility. There. Does anyone actually click on one of those ads, or are they just there just so they can annoy the hell out of me? Okay. Now, you see over... This is over a five-year period. Apple. Stock goes up and down and up and down. That's volatility. And we could say, well, is there a way we can measure that up and down of that stock by a number? And then maybe we could compare it to the volatility of something like, oh, I don't know. Let's try Sears over a five-year period. Well, that certainly did suck. 5 year. Notice that that is gracious. That notice that that has a lot more up and down, mostly down, but up and down. So we could, if we could figure out some way to measure these two volatilities by some formula, and then we could compare the volatilities. One is twice as volatile as the other, something like that. Go to something like, well, we did Urban Outfitters. Let's have a look at Urban Outfitters. Five-year, again. Oh, that's wildly volatile. Look at that little sucker. So if we could get a measure of this kind of volatility, well, maybe we can compare the risks of these three stocks by that volatility measure. Turns out that volatility in and of itself really doesn't matter in finance to your risk analysis, but it's a place to start. So taking that off the board just for a minute, just for a little bit here, how would we measure volatility by something that you have learned? Now, I assume you all had your statistics course. And in that course, they brought up a measure that was called the standard deviation, sigma. The first thing you do is you find the mean is the mean. And that is nothing but the weighted average if they're equal, I equals 1 to n of the sum of the data points, like that. And then the sigma is the sum from I equals 1 to n of each of the data points minus the mean squared, and all of that divided by n. Well, 1 over n, like that. Standard deviation is actually not a bad place to start. And in some parts of business, we do use those standard deviations. So, for example, let's take a revenue for next year. State of the economy. See what we can do here. State of the economy and the revenues that we would have. And let's just do something that's relatively fast, a five state. This is something that Excel could do very well. Now, in this way, what we're going to do is we're going to say that we don't know how the economy is going to do, but we have a good idea of what the revenues would be in that economy. It could be a very bad economy. Or it could be an excellent economy. Those would be the two outside possibilities. And also what we're going to do is we're going to put here the probabilities. Now, the probabilities would have to add up to 1 so that we could exhaust the event space, to put it in fancy terms. Oh, excuse me. Okay. Let's say that there is a 10% chance on each of these, 10% and 10%, on each of these possibilities. Okay. Actually, I screwed this up. There's no 1 over n on this, but there is a square root. I forgot I was going to do a standard deviation. Whoa. I need another one in here. Sorry about that. That's I said a 5 state. Wow. Okay. 10%. Excellent. Now, the economy might not be excellent or very bad. It might be kind of bad, pretty good, or it could be right in the middle. We'll call that meh. So, and 10%. And the kind of bad and the pretty good would be 20%. And the sort of middle economy would be 40%. So we make sure these add up, 10, 20, 30, that's 70, 80, 90, 100. So they add up. So let's say right in the middle economy, let's say that our revenues for next year will be $10,000. Pretty good. Let's say $12,000. Excellent, $14,000. a little bad, kind of bad, $8,000, very bad, $6,000. Now, this is actually something that is done in businesses. They use a little bit more, a more sophisticated model, probably more possibilities in here, finally dividing it up. But this is actually done in forecasting. So the first thing that we would want to do is say, what is the expected value? That's our expected value. The mean would simply be 10%, well, let me just write it out. 10% times 6,000 plus 20% times 8,000 plus 40% times 10,000 plus 20% times 12,000 plus 10% times 14,000. Okay, no big thing about that. Nothing big. Except you really don't have to do that calculation. I'll tell you what the answer is without even batting an eye. The answer is 10,000. The reason I know that is that this is a symmetric distribution, so that the expected value will be the center. Don't ever do this calculation if you identify that it's a symmetric distribution. Then you will know that the middle value is the center of the distribution. Well, then we've got to get the standard deviation, which would be the square root of this ungodly. We would have to take, 6,000, wait, sorry, let me do it in the right order. 10% times 6,000 minus 10,000 squared plus 20% times 8,000 minus 10,000 squared plus 40% times 10,000 minus 10,000 20 squared plus 20% times 12,000 minus 10,000 20 squared plus 10% times 14,000 minus 10,000 20 squared. And all of that, the square root of that whole thing. Now, if you're going to do that calculation, you're wasting a lot of time, because you can make that calculation a whole lot easier. Instead of this whole monster, calculating this whole thing out and then taking the square root, notice something. First of all, 10,000 minus 10,000 is zero, so the middle term, did I just have a stroke? Oh, God, I hate. Okay. Oh, and this is times the probability. Okay. First of all, the center term, you don't need to calculate because it'll always be zero. But wait a minute. This is a symmetric distribution. 12,000 minus 10,000 squared is the same as 8,000 minus 10,000 squared, times 20% on both of them. And 14,000 minus 10,000 20 squared is the same as 6,000 minus 10,000 20 squared. So I'm just doing the same calculation over again. So I don't really need to calculate these. All I need is to calculate these two backenders and then multiply the result times 2 before I do a square root. Make sure you see that, because that simplifies this. We're going to use this standard deviation formula over and over again. Why would you do all those killer calculations when really more than half of it is just a repetition? Just do the back end of it and multiply the result times 2 before you take the square root. That's all you ever have to do for a standard deviation. So in this case, if I were to honk that thing out, it's 0.20 times 2,000 squared plus 0.1 times 4,000 squared. And then I times that result by 2 to cover the front end that I didn't do. And then I just take the square root of that mess. I can't see worth. Oh. Square root. What do you get for that? Because I'm really, let's try that again. Square root of, what did that come out to be? 0.20 times 2,000 squared plus 0.1 times 4,000 squared, close the parentheses. The result of that should come out to be, whoops, I screwed that up. I sure did. 0.2, let's take the square root of 0.2, whoops, of 2 times 0.2 times 2,000 squared plus 0.1 times 4,000 squared. Close the parentheses, close the parentheses. 219089. Is that the number you get when you run that? Yeah, that should be. That's the standard deviation. It has a very practical use in a business, that standard deviation does. And you probably already saw this. That the standard deviation, if I were to look at a distribution of possible outcomes of revenue, the mean here is $10,000. The mean minus the standard deviation up to the mean plus the standard deviation, that would have a 90%? Yeah, I think something like that. 90% chance of happening. So in other words, I have a 90% chance that my revenue is going to be between 10,000 minus 2191 and 10,000 plus 2191. There's a 90% chance that that'll happen. There's a 95% chance. Okay. Take 10,000 minus 2191, and don't just dollars, because rounding to cents is kind of ridiculous because we're just doing real hard, real loose estimates anyway. So I want to do 10,000 minus 2191. So that would be 7809. up to 12, 1, 2, 1. It's 90% chance that my revenues are going to fall in that band. There's a 95% chance that they'll fall in a band from 2 sigmas down to 2 sigmas up. Whoops. So there's a 95% chance that I'm going to have 10,000 minus 2 times 2191, which would be 5618, up to 10,000 plus 2191 times 2, 14,382. And there's a 99% chance that I'll be within 3 sigmas, which would be 10,000 minus 2191 times 3, which is 3427, up to 10,000 plus 3 times 2191, which would be 16,573. The practical use of this is that I can do some budgeting based on these numbers. Well, I'm 99% sure that I'm not going to fall below about $3,400 in revenue. If I am very risk averse, that means that that probably would be as much as I would be willing to spend in have as expenditures, so that I'd be 99% sure that I would come up with a positive net income at the bottom line. If I'm really risk averse. Now, if I'm more of a risk taker, I'm 90% sure that I couldn't get any worse than, say, $7,800. So that might be where I would want to sit myself. But one way or the other, depending upon how averse you are to falling into negative net income, you at least have some framework here that says this is what could, these are the scenarios, and this is where you would be in each one. So I might, in my case, I might be, I really want to be 99% sure that I make positive income for one reason or another. And so I'm not going to spend more than about $3,000 on stuff this year just to make absolutely sure, well, not absolutely sure, but 99% sure that I'm not going to go into red ink at the net income line. That's what that does. It's not the greatest measure in the world, but it sure is a nice thing to have, at least in terms of overall volatility of revenues inside of the company. And like I said, in real application, in financial forecasting, internal forecasting for companies, a lot of them break this down into like 7, 9. Once you go too far, it gets kind of ridiculous. But 7 is one that you see, I've seen in my time, as far as forecasting goes. And then from the forecasting of the revenues, then you can start talking about capital budgeting, talking about how much money that you're going to be able to spend and all that kind of stuff. So there you are. Now, again, this is a measure. Sigma would be a measure that would be used inside of a company. But on the outside of a company, we're going to need something a little more robust than this kind of a measure. And there's a simple reason for that. It has to do with where volatility comes from. Volatility can come from a whole lot of different sources. And I'm going to take this off the board and go down. In external finance, the great big measure of risk is not sigma. It's a very practical thing that we've all seen. It's called interest rate. The interest rate is the measure of risk. Higher risk would mean a higher interest rate would be paid, or a higher interest rate would be implied in calculations. Interest rates are the primary in finance, external finance. But there's a problem even with that one. That's not the one we would use for the measure of risk in investments. In investments, we use a measure of risk called beta. Hear me well. Beta is the relative risk of a security in a diversified portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Beta is the risk of a security in a diversified portfolio relative to the market portfolio. Here's the deal. When I showed you that volatility thing with cost of medical care, showed you one person would have wild volatility. Add another person, and the two volatilities, because they're not perfectly correlated, help cancel each other out a little bit. And the more people you add, the more they cancel out some of the volatility of each other. The same is true in stocks. If I were to look at the volatility, and I'm going to put it in quotation marks because it's not exactly volatility, but it's like volatility, against the number of stocks in a portfolio, if I have one stock in a portfolio, the volatility of the portfolio is the volatility of that stock. If I were to put another stock in the portfolio, so I had two stocks in the portfolio, the volatilities of the two would partially cancel each other out a little bit, as long as they weren't perfectly correlated, so they swung exactly the same. If I put another one in, there's more of that cancellation of each other's volatility that happens, as long as they're not perfectly correlated. And as I add more and more securities, the total risk, will you get off my, of the whole portfolio falls. Now, theoretically, if you had a portfolio that had every stock of the economy in it, in proportion to the weight of that capital in the economy, you would ultimately get to the risk of the market portfolio. The market portfolio is that all of the stocks of the economy, each in its proportionate weight to the economy. So Apple would have a big weight in it, Microsoft would have a big weight, and then as the stocks got less and less significant, they'd have smaller weights in this perfect portfolio. It's a dream portfolio. It's the sort of the theoretical portfolio that you can't actually have, but it's nice to know that it is there. But the portfolio that you build will fall in its risk asymptotically toward the market portfolio. It won't reach it unless you get the market portfolio. So what are we talking about? Two issues here. First issue is, if you have a portfolio with one stock, you're a dumbass, because you have got huge amounts of diversifiable risk. You are taking on risk that you don't need to. Because if you were to put in more stocks in your portfolio, you wouldn't have that risk. No market is going to reward you for bearing diversifiable risk. So when you have these recommendations on TV or from some genius, well, buy this stock, you're a dumbass if you follow that advice. That's not, you're bearing enormous amounts of risk that no market, you should have no expectation of a reward for it. Another thing is, you can't hold the market portfolio. So what do you do instead? Here's the thing, 30 stocks in a portfolio, you have brought down the diversifiable risk by 95%. So in other words, in a 30 stock portfolio, yeah, you've got only a little bit of diversifiable risk. The rest is non-diversifiable, the risk of the market portfolio, or the risk relative to the market portfolio. 30 stocks is good enough. But suppose that you want to do better than that. What can you do? You can't buy the market portfolio. You don't have enough money to, and even if you could, it'd take you forever to set it up, and the transactions cost would kill you. That's why buying your own stocks is actually not such a bright idea. For one thing, transactions costs are going to eat you alive. Buying each of those stocks and having a broker shave a little bit off with each one. There are two ways that you can go to get diversification in your portfolio without having to build the portfolio yourself. The two best ways to do it are through what are called mutual funds and through ETFs. ETFs are electronically traded funds. Both of them have lots of stocks in them. A mutual fund, and you can join mutual funds on your own or through your work. You join the fund like TIAA CREF or Vanguard or one of those things. The fund manager, first of all, always go with a no load or at worst a low load. In other words, you're not paying them up front for what they're doing. You join the mutual fund. But, and then they say, okay, we have all these different portfolios you can choose from. Well, I like high risk. Okay, here's a high risk portfolio. I like international. Okay, here's a portfolio of international stocks. Well, I like technology stocks. Okay, here's a portfolio of technology stocks. They create the portfolio. The fund managers oversee it, control it, watch it. They make their money off you making yours. They invest for growth in the stock. Some of them are more growth-oriented with higher risk. Some of them are less growth-oriented with more safety. Some are stock, some are bonds, some are a mix. Those are mutual funds. Here's the downside of a mutual fund, which in some ways isn't so much of a downside. If you don't want to be in, let's say you are in a high-risk mutual fund, stocks that are higher risk, and you want to get out of it, you'll have four chances a year. You can't just trade in the mutual fund. You'll have windows where you can shift your portfolio. Okay, I was in 50% stock, 50% bond. I'd like to move over more towards stock mutual funds with stock funds within this group and away from bond funds. You can do that, but you can't do it whenever you want to. You have four chances a year. Now, ETFs, electronically traded funds, essentially, they are just a stock. You buy stock in a company that has bought stock in a bunch of companies. So essentially, what you're doing is you're buying stock in a portfolio of stocks. You can buy an ETF that is nothing but the stocks in the S&P 500, the Wilshire 5000, whatever, NASDAQ portfolio. The ETFs are all over the place, and they are stocks. So you can buy and sell them whenever you want. You call your broker. It's a stock, that ETF you own. You can buy more shares of it, sell shares of it anytime you want. Of course, you're going to pay a transaction fee every time you do that. That's something that a mutual fund won't do for you. They won't charge you when you shift. At least they shouldn't. So it's kind of a trade-off here. Mutual funds, you have low transactions costs, but you have limited ability to shift. With ETFs, you have complete freedom. You buy and sell like stock. You call your broker, I want to buy some more, or I want to sell some. On the fly, anytime, like any stock. But you're going to pay a transactions cost every time you do that. So which one is better? It's difficult. But the idea that you should be buying and selling stocks all the time is probably ranks right up there is as stupid as buying a One Direction album. Okay? It's not. If you think you're such a genius that you're jockeying stocks up and down, moving around, I've got to stay on the fly, I heard a rumor, so I'm going to buy some of this and sell some of that. You're playing against giants that are going to whip your ass every time. The way you make money in a stock market, if you're going to make money, is through a buy and hold strategy. Period. You can't beat Goldman Sachs because they see the future. They are looking and trading on the future. You can't beat that. Your strategy is to buy and hold. And also, here's another thing too. I'm going to give you this as a secret about investing in a down market, what you do in a down market. Here's the rule. Don't shit your pants. You see, the problem is that if you see a market starting to go down, you start panicking, you join the herd on the way down, well, you're going to end up like the mice, the stomped under, trampled under in the down hurricane. And then on the upside, by the time you identify the upside, the big dogs have already identified it and they've bid the prices back up. In the crash of 2008, there were a lot of investors who just lost their water and they just sold. Of course, they sold pretty much down at the bottom, lost their asses, and they have never recovered. The people who just sat there and let the market ride down and they just held their portfolios, maybe did so a little adjustment, but they didn't lose their water, they're ahead insanely. Well, now, stocks go down, they go up. Buy and hold, and you will ride the trend wave, which is upward over 100, 200 years. The stock trend is upward. Now, you're not going to live 100, 200 years, but you'll live long enough to recover from anything your stock does. It was like the question was put to one of the Waltons when the stock of the Walmart dropped so much that I think in one day, one of the family members lost $1 billion. What are you going to do now? This reporter said. And he just said, it was paper then, it's paper now. That's all there is to it. Look, there are going to be times in your life when you do want to shift your portfolio, the balance of it. And let's see. Four kids, two wives, a house in the suburbs, a boat. In your early years, you're not going to have those problems. You can have a riskier portfolio, tilted more towards stocks, tilted more towards riskier stocks that would have higher potential growth, capital gains. But as you get older, you're not going to want to roll the dice as much. You're going to have responsibilities to have things for the future. So you're going to back off the stocks, maybe move a little bit more toward bonds, and also make sure that you're not in such a high-risk portfolio. And then in your old age, you're going to want a very low-risk portfolio. Bonds, probably, or preferred stock, or stocks that have very low growth, but they are very sure to survive kinds of things. So there, you're going to be moving through different ages in your life, and those are the places where you do your shifting. Also, if you do have the judgment that there is bad time coming, it doesn't hurt to move in a mutual fund. You're in a mutual fund. You've got a couple of different mutual funds. Let's say you've got a balance. It's 80% stock, 20% bonds. If there is a good sense in your mind that times are not going to be good, you do want to shift somewhat. Moving from stocks to bonds is what is called the flight to quality. In other words, remember the bondholders have the prior claim on assets of a corporation. So even if the corporation goes tap city, the bondholders are going to be the ones made whole first. Bonds, in that way, are less risky than stocks. They are a higher quality of instrument. So when we see markets where investors in large numbers are selling stocks and using the proceeds to go to bonds, that's a flight to quality that's happening. You might keep an eye on some of the major indices, stock indices and bond indices, just to see if there is evidence of a flight to quality. And then you might want to rebalance your portfolio toward more bond funds and fewer stock funds, or at least toward less risky stocks. That's flight to quality. The old saying goes, from stocks to bonds, from bonds to gold, from gold to bullets. So if you have to go and buy bullets, well, all bets are off anyway. But it's your call. Whichever way you want, mutual funds, ETFs, making your own portfolio is, that puts you into the realm of something really, really dark and bad. They call them day traders. It's a sad world if you end up being a day trader. Now I'm going to show you something here. I'm going to get something up here. Remember that this measure beta is the metric of the non-diversifiable risk of a security or a portfolio relative to the market portfolio. So in other words, the beta of the market portfolio is 1 because the relative risk of the market portfolio to itself is exactly 100%. The beta of a treasury bill is 0 because a treasury bill will pay. So those are 2 anchors. And so you kind of think of those as sort of your stopping points on the road. Know this, the beta of a treasury bill is 1, or I'm sorry, 0. So that means, does that mean that a treasury bill has no volatility? It does. Beta measures only the volatility relative to the market portfolio. Any security can have a lot of volatility. Beta is not going to measure it because beta assumes that you're not stupid and you're not holding the thing by itself. So you'll see treasury bills, price goes up and down a little bit. But none of that is non-diversifiable volatility. The non-diversifiable risk is 0. So without further ado, let's go back here. And this was Urban Outfitters. A beta of 1.38. In other words, in a well-diversified portfolio, the volatility of this stock relative to the market portfolio is about 138%. In other words, it is riskier than the market portfolio in terms of non-diversifiable risk. That doesn't mean that the stock itself is 138%. It probably, if you just took overall risk, it would be huge. But this measures only the part for which you should expect to be rewarded. You're bearing greater risk than the market portfolio, so you should expect a greater return. but only on the non-diversifiable component. Let's try a couple more here. Well, let me look at Sears. I'm just curious. Whoa, hello. That's a big number. In technical terms, we call that a big ass number. 3.09, 309% of the... that's huge, actually. You don't see numbers like that. Wow. Just out of curiosity. Well, that kicked my ass. Interesting. Look at that. JCPenney, as far as risk goes, non-diversifiable risk, that's still a big risk. I mean, those are serious betas. Anytime you get a beta above about 1.4, 1.3, that's risk. That's you're building a risky portfolio doing that. But JCPenney, that kind of surprises me that it's not considered as risky relative to the market portfolio as JCPenney is. Let's talk here about a few other ones. ExxonMobil. It is it's pretty much a defensive stock. Its non-diversifiable risk is only 89% of the market portfolios. In other words, this company is a safe investment, relatively speaking. Try another one here. I looked at Apple and then I forgot. Apple is actually a safe stock, relatively speaking. It's not, I wouldn't call this a defensive stock necessarily, but it's a relatively safe stock. Out of curiosity here, MSFT. Beta, for the love of God. MSFT. Even safer. Well, Bill Gates owns the universe. Other stocks. Let's try Walgreens. $1.19. A little above. Let's see its competitor, CVS. Ooh, below. Same industry, but if you like those kinds of stocks, if you want to go risky, go Walgreens. If you want to go not so risky, go CVS in that industry. Any others that what you would call out? Facebook. Oh, goody. Hot damn. Really? Oh, goody. We get back to that screen. Okay, let's try that again. Facebook, FB. Ooh, isn't that interesting? A low beta, which also means, though, that you can't expect as much as far as a return goes as you would with the market portfolio with Facebook. What else would be on the agenda here? Chipotle? Chipotle. CMG. Oh, chimichanga. Okay. How lame can you get? Low risk. Now, let's interpret it. The one thing that you always want to look for is the spread of revenue. The more outlets a company has, the more diversified its revenue base, which gives it more chance to survive if there are regional economic problems. Also, eating is something that people do. And so you would tend to expect these to be a little bit stronger in terms of that kind of thing, as less risky. Because Chipotle, there are tons of them out there. And also, they tend to be something that a lot of people will go to, like on a weekly or a biweekly basis. So there's a wide breadth of interest in this. What else would go on here? Okay, call it. High beta or low beta? Oh, give those guys a cigar. That is a low beta, low risk, but also remember that it has low non-diversifiable risk, which means that you have low expected return on it. Berkshire Hathaway? Okay, this is B. Now, B and A, there are different classes. A beta of 0.29. That's almost essentially, Warren Buffett is essentially a treasury bill. Low risk, extremely low risk. But remember what that means, is that with low risk comes low expected return. You think old Warren's going to share his billions and trillions with you? Like hell. Look at the stock. Let's go out. Let's look at what it's had over a five-year history. Notice something interesting about this. And now I'm going to do a little bit of technical analysis. I'm glad you did Berkshire. Mine was lame compared to Berkshire. Look at this. Do you notice something odd about Berkshire? It's what we call a burster. That's what we used to call it. For the most part, you buy this stock, you're going to have a very lame experience. And then you're going to have an exciting yee-haw, and then it's going to do that again. It'll lose, and that'll scare away. That'll drive out the longs, and then it'll have another burst, and then it'll ride doing nothing, and then it'll burst again. That is actually not, in my judgment, that's not an interesting stock to me at all. Because, I mean, that stock is more like, when is this actually going to do something? Oh, that's right, it's a 0.29 beta. It's not going to do something except for once in a great while. It'll give you an exciting ride to a new level, and then it'll just sit there with your money doing nothing again. So, from a technical analyst's point of view, looking at a stock chart, this thing is, if you loved yourself some Warren, fine. But other than that, that's not something that would be of interest to me. Now, let's get a couple of things here. The beta at zero is a T-bill. Beta of one is a market portfolio. Does that mean that if you find a stock that has a beta of one, it has the risk of the market portfolio? No. It has the non-diversifiable risk of the market portfolio. But in and of itself, it'll be a much riskier stock because you're bearing risk that is not measured by beta. Now, here's the next thing. There are some stocks that have negative betas, slightly negative betas. These stocks actually, their risk profile runs opposite of the market. It doesn't just run slower or faster than the market. It runs counter to the market. And there are mutual funds you can buy that have these stocks in them. They're called contrarian funds. Contrarian funds. The most likely place you'll find a contrarian fund, gold mining stocks. You'll run into them in gold mining because gold runs counter to the economy. So gold mining stocks, now you're not going to see huge negative betas, but you'll see, I pulled up one just on the fly one semester. It had a beta of negative 0.65. And so if you are if you're contrarian, if you just believe that when everyone else believes that it's all sunshine and goodness, that's when you believe that hell is coming, contrarian funds are for you. And like I said, mutual funds, you can find them where they will go out against the market. So if you think the zombie apocalypse is going to happen tomorrow, go to a contrarian fund. They will do well in a zombie apocalypse. As long as you don't forget the double tap and all of that. I don't think this one has a negative. Does it even have a beta? And the reason I'm not getting any recommendations here. Let's try this. Why does it keep doing that? Okay. Gold resources. That's an ETF. See that? Look at that. That's a nice ETF. And we don't have any. Is there some reason I keep running into things that don't have a damn beta? Let's try this. By the way, ETFs do have betas. But ABX, I don't think it. Ooh, low. See how that one's closing in, going towards a zero beta, but it's not a zero. Just to try. Yamana doesn't have a negative beta, I'm pretty sure. See how low they are, though? Those gold mining stocks, those gold stocks are going to have low. And I'm trying to find one real quick that has a negative beta, but I'll bet I'm not going to do it. Yeah, that was a little higher. Let me try something here real quick.
Verizon Wireless has a negative beta.
What? Well, that's because if the universe ends, everyone's going to be using his damn cell phone to text about how cool it is. $207 billion market cap on that SOB. Son of a bitch. That's a treasury bill. In other words, Verizon is basically the government. As a matter of fact, it's a little bit safer than the government. No, noobs, I don't think you understand. That is the government. I don't even look at those huge stocks like that. But you see that. Essentially, Verizon is the market portfolio, is a treasury. That is just so creepy that it... Bank of America. Whoa, look at that one. Citi. Really? There's some reason that sucks. There it is. Look at those banks. Why are those banks having betas that are actually the kind that make your back leg go up and down a little bit? That's an interesting thing. If you want high-risk investments, you would form a portfolio of bank stocks. These big, giant banks, too big to fail. Well, the way those are measuring, the market says you better hope that the government thinks they're too big to fail because those are risky betas. I mean, remember what I said. Above 1.4, and this is just my personal judgment, above 1.4, you're talking more risk than a lot of people would be willing to take. But damn, these are up there. What's another big bank?
Chase.
Chase. Get out of the way. Look at that. Key. Key is a bank holding company. That one's not as bad, but that's still up there. The banking sector, which a long time ago, the banking sector would have been considered like real safe, you know, the place where you have, I mean, no company's going to fail that has wood grain and marble in the customer lobby. So now that they don't have those fancy marble stuff and wood and they tie your pens down, apparently that makes them not as safe now. But that's an interesting thing right there. Now, as far as gaming industry, can you give me a gaming company?
Yeah,
what? KNG?
K-I-N-G.
King. That's Burger King, you idiot. That's Class F stock. That's an ADR. I'd look for one here. How about Electronic Arts? Are they even still in business? Whoa, that's interesting. Low beta. That's a low beta stock. That's a relatively safe stock. Okay, you get the idea. And this actually empowers you as an investor to know one of our classic measures. Beta is like one that no matter how many theoreticians try to find something better, we turn back to beta all the time. So that's all I have for you today. I thank you.